www.thebrainfarm.com.
This is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast, and I'm here with Martin. How are you, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad, Chris. How are you, mate?
Yeah, not bad, not bad. How's your cheer mining coming? So the topic of the week, it seems to be our biggest thing to talk about at the moment.
Oh, well, I've got 149 plots now, but no cheer.
Ah, okay. Well, I've only got about 5, so there's no chance of me getting anything, is there?
No.
It'll be a while yet.
How many years does it estimate you're going to have to keep going for?
12 at the moment, I think.
12. I think somebody said, so I know some of you had one, and it estimates 47 years.
Wow, okay.
But then it could be lucky, it could be tomorrow.
Could be. So what we do need is probably some better technology, some faster and some more dynamic technology to help us build stuff to do this. And there's an interesting opening into introducing our guest this week, Sumit Puri from Liquid. Hi, Sumit, how are you?
Hey, gentlemen, how are you doing? Good to be here.
Would you like to just introduce the company and give us a bit more detail?
Absolutely. Afternoon, everybody. My name is Sumit Puri. I'm the CEO and co-founder here at Liquid. Liquid is a leader in driving the market towards a dynamic data center or a software-defined data center. And the key technology that we've been developing over the last 7+ years is a piece of software and some fabric technology that enables what the market refers to as composable disaggregated infrastructure, or CDI, or composable, as some people call it.
Great. So I think Martin and I have talked about composable in general, but would you just give everybody, you know, what definition perhaps of what you would class as composable, so we can level set and then we can sort of go into a bit more detail?
No, that's great. Yeah. So, you know, lots of different definitions in the industry today around how we define composable. Liquid's definition, I think, is important, right? Legacy servers are very simply defined. We take devices, we plug them into the sockets of the motherboard, and we define how our server is configured. In composable, what we do is it's all about pools of resources. So pools of storage, pools of compute. These days, a lot of pools of GPUs. We don't care what the actual device is. Instead of plugging the device directly into a motherboard, we plug those devices into a switch. And then we come in with software and we dynamically configure our server. Grab this 1U pizza box, grab 5 of those storage things from that tray, grab 12 of those GPUs from that pool over there, interconnect them together at the bare metal, just like we were plugging it into the motherboard, except we define it in software, and on the other side, we get delivered a server, however big or small we want our server to be, and that server is dynamically reconfigurable. So if my mining workload needs another SSD, we don't send a guy to the data center with a cart and plug in actual hardware. We simply reprogram that fabric layer, and we add or remove devices from the server depending on either what the application layer or what the user requires, right? And so that's our definition of composable.
Fantastic. Martin, we've talked about composable on and off for a while, and it seems like a really interesting concept, but perhaps it'd be wrong of us to think it's limited to just something very simple in terms of wanting to continually re-dynamically build and destroy infrastructure. It potentially sounds, you know, like a lot more can be done with it, and I think we're going to dig into that in a moment.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I do remember the first time we really came across composable, and that was probably at an HP Discover.
Yeah.
When they first pushed the machine.
Yes.
That was interesting, but I don't think we really was right from a point of view. We didn't quite really see the use cases, but I think now we're beginning to see how you're going to use it, and I think there is obviously the dynamic data center, putting things up and down. But I think we're going to get into some of this about the other things you're going to be able to do with this.
Yeah, and you're right, the HP stuff was interesting, but it seemed to be, at the time, it seemed a bit more of a science experiment. And I think it seemed like, you know, there wasn't really sort of a lot of reality behind it. So, Sumit, let's dig into understanding a bit more about what you can do today, the sorts of components you can do this composability with, and obviously what you can't. But let's start with what you can do today. I mean, you mentioned GPUs, you mentioned lots of things there already.
Yeah, no, so it's a good question, right? And so a couple of things that make, you know, the Liquid solution what we believe to be, you know, one of the more comprehensive composable solutions on the market, first and foremost, is our ability to support multiple fabric types. So we can compose devices over a PCIe interconnect, We can support devices over an Ethernet interconnect. We can support devices over an InfiniBand interconnect. And soon the industry will have something referred to as CXL as a way of interconnecting. So first and most important, we need the right tool for the right job. So we have to be a multi-fabric composer, right? So that's number one. And the second thing is we have different devices that we need to be able to compose. You can't say that you're a composable solution if the only thing that you do is map an SSD over Ethernet to a host. That's NVMe over fabric, and that's not a complete comprehensive solution. You have to be able to compose storage. You have to be able to compose GPUs, FPGAs, networking cards, DPUs, soon disaggregated memory. And so you have to be able to support all the device types. Now, not all devices over all interconnects. Different devices work better over different interconnects. For example, PCIe is a great fit for composing GPUs, but Ethernet is a great fit for composing NVMe, for example. So different tools for different jobs. Liquid composes all fabrics that are relevant today, and we compose all device types that are relevant also.
So I think that's quite interesting. So first of all, the fact that the obvious thing is that most of these devices, you'd expect them to connect via PCIe into an existing motherboard, you know, physically slotted into a PCIe slot, potentially if you're building a server. But we know that you can get PCIe switches, and they've been around for a while. And lots of vendors have started to use those in their storage solutions, for example. But I think the interesting point you've made there is that we already have the ability to do things like NVMe over Ethernet and obviously InfiniBand. So that could be done using that route. It doesn't all have to be done over PCIe. So there are ways and means to do this without having to go down the same route each time. But at the end of the day, you are going to be putting a fabric in of some sort to connect all these devices. And that's the central part of the architecture, I think, from what I've seen.
That's correct, right? In some use cases, it may be only an Ethernet composability thing. In some use cases, it may be only a PCIe composability thing. And today we actually do a lot of multi-fabrics, where I'll have two fabric connections into the server at the same time, and I'm going and I'm grabbing my storage devices over Ethernet. At the same time, I'm grabbing my GPU devices over PCIe. And so at the end of the day, you know, multi-fabric is a lot of what our customers are focused on.
What about DRAM memory? That seems to be probably the most challenging one to put in place, because at the end of the day, everything you've talked about so far typically sits on a bus that's either PCIe connected or at least not on the memory bus. You know, and there's a big difference between the memory bus, where we see DRAM and potentially opt-in DIMMs sitting today, and then there's everything else, which would be classed as technically a peripheral sitting on what, you know, I think I remember it used to being called the northbound and the southbound interfaces, but that's probably an Intel architecture from like 10 years ago.
That's right.
You had that like storage infrastructure, didn't you, where, or the peripheral infrastructure. And it seems that we haven't quite got to the point where composability of DRAM is there. But you mentioned CXL, which could be the thing that gives us the ability to at least integrate some degree of memory into this.
Yeah, so today, you know, it's a data center first. Everything, for the first time, all the devices are on this common bus. Where does storage go? PCIe. Where does the GPU go? PCIe. Where does the FPGA plug in? PCIe. Where does the NIC go? That even goes into the PCIe bus. How does the compute talk to all the devices? PCIe. And as you said, Chris, the last thing not on PCIe is actually DRAM, right? DRAM today remains on the DDR bus. Eventually, we believe that disaggregated memory is going to be a really important part of the data center architecture. Liquid is already working on disaggregating DRAM over CXL, and that will be eventually the preferred interface of how we disaggregate traditional DRAM. Today, we do things like Optane on top of PCIe Gen 4 as a way to disaggregate memory. The final endpoint will eventually be CXL as a means to disaggregate large pools of DRAM. And we are already working on that with partners like Samsung.
Martin, I'm just trying to think of what a typical server might look like in this scenario. You can see it being very minimal, can't you? So, you know, so CPUs of various different flavors and a minimal amount of memory to get you to boot and to give you a certain degree of, you know, working set memory. But after that, it looks like everything else could be composable.
Yeah, it's going to make it very interesting. It will make data center design interesting. It will make how you lay your racks out. You could have all kinds of challenges, because I think the initial people say, I tell you what, I have a rack full of GPUs and I'll just connect it. And then your data center people will look at you like you're mad because you've just built a hotspot, a massive hotspot. A rack full of DRAM, same problem, massive hotspot, massive things. So there are going to be challenges. There's going to be some physical challenges about how you lay out your data center to take advantage of this new disaggregated hardware.
I would say that's possibly true, but possibly it could be both an advantage and disadvantage, because you could decide to dedicate certain areas, you know, half a rack of GPUs, half a rack of something else. It might give you a bit more scope to be able to put things where you want them. But Sumit, do you see customers doing that, choosing how to lay racks out and you know, come out with different designs?
Yeah, no, all kinds of interesting things become, you know, possible when we begin to disaggregate. And so I'll give you one kind of turn the contrast up use case is I'm going to put all of my GPUs into one rack, and that is the rack I'm going to put my extraordinary cooling efforts on. I'm going to buy the refrigerated door, I'm going to pay for the extra power, and I'm going to consolidate all of that down to a single rack. What that means is now I have only one physical spot that I need to actually apply extraordinary cooling to, and the rest of my racks can remain kind of as is. So that's one thing that we see. The other thing that we see is when you take the GPUs out of the chassis, for example, the GPUs themselves run 10 to 15 degrees cooler. And the reason is simple. I am not cooling the GPUs with dirty air. In a normal server, the GPUs are going past the storage, past the compute, past the DRAM, and then they're eventually going to hit the GPUs, and you're already hitting them with dirty air. When we take the GPUs out and we disaggregate them into their own pool, we're feeding them with cold air, and inherently we run 10 to 15 degrees cooler on the GPUs. Less power, less cooling, less heat, less reliability concerns. There's a lot of benefits. And oh, by the way, now all of those servers where previously I was buying two 1500 watt power supplies because I was planning on putting the GPUs in those servers, I can step it down to now two 750 watt power supplies because my GPU pool has now moved to a different, you know, power profile. So all kinds of interesting things become possible when you begin to disaggregate.
Yeah, I think, Martin, looking at that, there's other things that spring to mind for me, and that's things like cheaper servers you can make more disposable, servers you can do very lightweight, servers that can just all sit as one U servers because you don't need all the height and the power and all the other components that go in. So potentially you could really minimize your server footprint because you've extracted all of those components out into other racks, and all of a sudden, now you've got the compute part being relatively lightweight.
Yeah, and it also makes it much easier to upgrade and migrate workloads and change your hardware. You might decide that you want to replace all your GPUs. If they're all in their own rack, it's going to be a lot easier than having to go into each individual one. A server GPU fails, it's much easier to swap out potentially. Obviously, you've got disaggregate. You can just disable it, pull it out of the rack you've got the GPUs in and replace it. So yeah, I can see that there are a lot of advantages, but it does mean that people are going to have to get their head around to potentially how they design their data centers and their computing environments in future. And these things are never happen quite as fast as everybody would like them to.
I guess, you know, we have seen some of this sort of technology before, haven't we? So SANs were pretty much like that. So, you know, it was a consolidation of the physical disk capacity across a network. We've seen other manufacturers who've done similar sorts of backplane technology that allowed you to dynamically reconfigure. And let's face it, we should talk about the mainframe at this point because Martin and I's favorite discussion, the mainframe gave you the ability through the sort of master console of the actual machine to dynamically reconfigure workloads. So I think, first of all, there's precedent in the sense that it's a requirement that people are very keen on. And two, it's been done and we have an operational understanding of how to actually manage quite a lot of this, so it's not like we're starting from scratch, I guess.
Yeah, you mentioned the word SAN, right? And not that this is the best acronym, but we think of this as a bit of a CAN, right? A component area network, right? It's not just about the storage, right? This is about the GPUs, the FPGAs, the compute, the networking. It's about all the components. Let's put all the components on the network and change the way that we fundamentally consume these things, right? When we put storage onto the network, we fundamentally change the way storage was consumed. At the data center level, right? It was no longer consumed the same way. And our belief is the same thing will happen with the balance of the components when we can put them onto the network. Now, the question is, what is the appropriate network to put them onto? And the answer is multi-network, right? For some devices, you're going to want to put the storage For example, on Ethernet, some devices like the GPU, you're going to want to put that on the PCIe network. And things like memory, you're going to want to put it on the CXL network. And I know there's people on the podcast that are cringing right now saying PCIe is not a network, right? But that's not the point, right? It's about disaggregating it, putting it on the other side of a wire, and then making it movable and composable for what we're trying to do at the workload level, right?
Yeah, I always struggle with trying to not write PCIe network when I write it down. But I've got to the point where I just think, well, do you know what? At the end of the day, I know what the protocol is at the bottom end. I know that it's not a network protocol in the same sense. But in some respects, you've just got to write it in that sense or that fashion because, you know, that's what you're doing effectively. You're networking these things together.
That's right. Right. And so, a lot of that networking mindset does come into play when we start thinking about disaggregation inherently, right?
We keep talking about network, and sometimes I think actually we did ourselves a big disservice in the world of computing. We just should have just called it Fabric all along.
Yeah, that's true. I agree. It is Fabric.
I agree, yeah. Right. At the end of the day, that's what a Fabric is. A Fabric is a network of some type, right? Agreed.
Okay, let's dig into your technology in a bit more detail then. So you've explained, you know, that you're using multiple Fabric types and that we're going to be able to connect devices across multiple different interfaces. What about when we start looking at the management of this? How are you doing that side of it? You know, how is this whole thing pulled together in terms of the infrastructure?
Yeah, so that's a really important part of it, right? So number one is, I think it's important to kind of mention this, is the way that we look at our software is very kind of similar to VMware, right? As VMware slices and dices infrastructure in a virtualized environment, Liquid is slicing and dicing infrastructure at the physical layer, right? We are, in essence, acting as that physical layer hypervisor. So it's important to understand the function of the software. Now, all of that functionality is great only if it's easy to use, right? And so a lot of what Liquid is focused on is not only controlling multiple fabric types, controlling multiple device types, but then actually making all of this stuff usable in a real world environment, right? And so what that ends up happening is pulling the strings of the fabric, as we say, there's multiple ways that we do that. How do you go off and reconfigure? How do you go off and dynamically compose? So the first way that we do that or we enable that is through our GUI. We have a really intuitive GUI. It's click and dragging of hardware. Literally, we can run it on an iPad app and you can move hardware around by swiping things around, right? So that's number one way of manipulating the fabric per se. Now, that's more of a marketing tool. As some of our larger customers, that's not how they're going to control a 1,000-node environment, right? That's more of, you know, giving a demonstration of what's possible. The GUI, though, is actually built upon a REST API. And there's two things that we do with that REST API. Number one is we give our customers the ability to script directly against our API. We'll give them sample code. We'll give them all of the calls. We'll give them a very well-documented command sets that if they wanted to pick up something like Python and begin to script and begin to manipulate the fabric, they can go off and go do that. The second thing that we do with our API is we integrate Northbound. We integrate with existing orchestration tools inside the data center. Today, we're integrated with things like Slurm, right? The Slurm is the preferred orchestration tool for HPC environments. We're integrating with things like Kubernetes. We're integrating directly with things like VMware. This next quarter, we are launching a plugin for vCenter where directly from the VMware layer, you are going to be able to go down into the physical infrastructure and say, hey, hypervisor, give me another storage thing at the bare metal. I want to chop it up. Hey, give me another GPU. I got a storage, you know, VDI workload that I want to go off and service. So the big usable piece of this thing is how we integrate Northbound with the existing orchestration frameworks that our customers use, right? And so That's a large portion of what we are focused on at the software layer.
Martin, we're into interesting ground here now because we're composing hardware to give into a virtual environment, which is then going to carve that piece of hardware up itself into something that it might be giving out to virtual machines. So we've got yet another layer of inception coming on here that's allowing us to do even more than we could do before.
Oh, we're just going to end up with crazy management tools, and anybody operating this is trying to work out what's talking to what is going to have some great fun. How do you visualize all this?
Yeah, so let's not try to reinvent the wheel. People are using things like vCenter. Let's enable vCenter to go do this, right? People are thinking about things like Terraform, right? Infrastructure as code. Well, let's give them real infrastructure as code, not like synthetic infrastructure as code. So a large portion of this is I don't want to go compete with Puppet, Ansible, Chef, Terraform, Kubernetes, Slurm, VMware, and the other dozen, you know, orchestration layers that are out there. Our vision is let's integrate with the tools that our customers are already using and make all of this seamless. That's really the focus here, right? If I got to get people to go use my thing instead of VMware, that's the wrong battle to be fighting here, right? My VMware doesn't do what I do. I don't do what VMware do. If we can marry these two things together, that is actually how we get to 100% resource utilization in the data center.
Yeah, that for me is, I think, really important, because at the end of the day, you're giving me the flexibility to do something I couldn't do before, but that's pretty irrelevant if I can't actually align it to what I'm already doing. And people are not going to throw away their VMware environments and start again. People are not going to throw away all of the stuff that they're used to doing. What they want is that next level of flexibility that says, well, this server that we were going to deploy this into, or this infrastructure, this ecosystem, we now need some extra capacity in it, or we need to do something in that environment for a short amount of time. Being able to do that within the context of the same infrastructure. And more importantly, things like SRM, you know, the tools that allow you to realize that you haven't got enough resources and drag the additional resources in dynamically and then release them when you're finished. Those sort of tools exist already. Why recreate those when all you're going to do is just give people just increased flexibility rather than replacing things?
That's right. That's our view. And in addition to that, we are going to have policy-based management at our layer for those customers that maybe are not already sophisticated enough to be orchestrating from a Kubernetes or something like that, right? And so at the Liquid Command Center layer, you're going to be able to compose a machine, and then with that machine, set up a handful of policies. When the storage on this machine goes above 80% utilized, automatically reprogram the fabric and give me more storage, right? At 10 o'clock at night, when I know nobody is going to be using that GPU, well, let's take that GPU and go coin mine for the next 8 hours and get 100% utilization out of my hardware. Literally, we had a customer ask us, can you give me the money button? I want a button in the software that says the moment that GPU is not in use or that FPGA is not in use, I hit a button and that device goes and mines for me until I'm ready to use it again. Now, if I got to go do that with a screwdriver and like move hardware around, like, no one's actually going to do that. If I can set up a policy within 10 seconds that I can flip a device to go earn me money, the payback that we saw is 4 years. 4 years at 50% usage, I will pay for an FPGA. Most people aren't using their FPGAs 50% of the time anyways, right? So listen, I say it in tongue in cheek a little bit, but you know, all kinds of interesting things become possible when we're not islanding our hardware behind a single server, right?
Yeah, you say tongue-in-cheek, but to a certain degree, with all of the stuff that we ever deal with technology-wise, we end up creating static configurations. And we tend to leave them for a number of reasons. One, because they're hard to take down and rebuild. Two, because we don't like risk that we might take something down that we shouldn't take down. And as a result, we tend to leave things as they are, because that's a better state than it is continually changing stuff. So you've got to have a certain degree of confidence that you what you do is going to work. And I think people got used to that with things like VMware, because that gave you that ability to do that pretty seamlessly. And nowadays, you wouldn't even think about it. Perhaps it's just going to take that little bit of time for people to get used to that idea of composing the hardware. But when they do, I think people are going to go, hang on, I can do so many different things. And there's going to be a real uptake that people realize they can do some significantly different approaches to things. And at the end of the day, this isn't going to be about being more efficient with resources necessarily, I guess. This is going to be about being creative too. And that's, I guess, where the value comes in.
I think there's, at the end of the day, you can have the greatest technology, and you know, you can turn water into wine. If at the end of the day there's not a economic benefit on the other side of it, it's going to be very hard to convince people to do something that's just cool, right? Cool only takes you so far, right? And so really, at the end of the day, it's the economics that are going to drive the adoption of technologies like disaggregation and composable, because inherently these technologies will save our customers money. There is no bigger knob that you can turn in the data center related to TCO than utilization rates of very expensive hardware. If I can take a rack of GPUs that's sitting there 20% utilized because they're stuck behind a server. And I can move those GPUs around to servers that need them and squeeze 50, 60, 70% utilization out of those GPUs. There is no bigger knob to turn in the data center around dollars back in my pocket than that, right? And so that will drive, you know, adoption related to the economics of it. But that dynamic use case that I mentioned there, that's a very simple, easy, simple, you know, use case. Let me give you kind of a more even like different use case. We had a customer come to us that said, I need to deploy 100 GPUs. The server box that I buy holds 2 GPUs a piece. Therefore, I need to buy 50 servers. And we said to them, well, what if we could give you 10 GPUs per server? Well, now I only need to buy 10 servers. We completely changed the economics of the way that that customer was going to go deploy their workload, right? And they didn't move to us because we were cool. They moved to us because it's changing the math.
And that's not actually a viable configuration, I wouldn't have thought, putting 10 GPUs into a physical server. Or if you can, it must be super expensive. So connecting them directly through this sort of process is something that you're sort of going against what is actually, you know, generally available in the market, never mind anything else.
That's right. And actually what they did it to, they bought a standard 1U pizza box from, you know, our one of our favorite server vendors, Dell, and they were able to actually take 20 GPUs and connect it to that 1U pizza box.
Martin, come on, that's mad. That's crazy, surely. That can't be something that people would, you'd think would want to do. But if you can do it and you can drive the throughput, because surely there's the big deal, you know, driving those GPUs. As long as you can drive the GPUs, you're all good.
Sorry, Martin, I was just going to mention, imagine when the GPUs are on the same fabric as the storage, and now we have the ability to feed the beast, as they say, right? Take massive amounts of storage throughput that exist on that PCIe fabric and directly RDMA it into those GPUs. That is how we are going to unleash the next level of storage / GPU performance here.
All brings us back to mining. The miners have been doing this for a while, actually. You can get, but they have impossible machines. So because they just extend the PCIe bus outside of their system and just have all these graphics cards hanging off them. So the concept of having a machine which has 8, 16 GPUs off it, I mean, I'm sure there are people listening to a podcast who might be into mining and think, yeah, that's nothing, but that's nothing new. But it is a static configuration at that point.
It's a static configuration, usually running by one connections to each of the GPUs. In our world, we can run 16 GPUs with a by 16 connection to each one of them, and then fan that out to a host which has 128 gigabytes of bandwidth coming in. So for those that want to dive deep into the architecture, we'd welcome the conversation and show you what the art of the possible might be.
Fantastic. Okay, let's go and talk about more about those sort of configurations and those use cases, because at the very top of this, I sort of highlighted the fact that we've talked about the idea that composable seems to be mostly about, oh, well, I can just tear it down, build it, rebuild it, and rebuild, you know, every couple of hours and move stuff over here, do that. But, you know, I would imagine a lot of people generally don't do that because of what we've just said earlier. So it would be a bit of a mistake to think that that's the only use case. And you've already highlighted one, Sumit, that talks about this idea of, we call it the impossible machine, but, you know, what we've just discussed, that configuration. What other use cases can we point to?
Yeah, no, that's great. And so what I'll say here is maybe half the stuff that we win these days is because of the dynamic capability. There's a lot of adoption for this technology beyond just dynamically moving things around. I'll give you just a handful of examples. Number one is scale out. There is no more efficient way to scale out the data center than to disaggregate. Add trays of just storage, add trays of just GPU, don't go pay for all of those other devices. Though we'd like to say the fundamental issue with hyperconvergence is the fact that it's converged. As we scale out, we get too much of one thing, not enough of another. Through disaggregation, we can more efficiently scale out. The other benefit is around decoupling our purchasing decisions, right? Today, if I go to my favorite server vendor and I say, give me a box with 8 GPUs or 10 GPUs, they're likely going to say, here's dual proc or quad proc system, because that's the way that we sell it. 10 GPUs equals quad proc. Well, in our world, we don't do that. If a customer wants to buy 20 GPUs and attach it to a single socket server, well, we can enable that and we can decouple their purchasing decisions. We do a lot of brownfield, right? Meaning that this is not just a greenfield play. Our customers have invested in infrastructure. We can come in brownfield environments, bolt on trays of storage, bolt on trays of GPUs to the existing infrastructure that they already own, right? And so for us, the brownfield opportunity is as large as net new infrastructure being put out there. We talked about the impossible server configuration. You know, give me a server with 20 GPUs. Give me a server with 16 GPUs and 16 NICs. Nobody bends sheet metal like that, but with Composable, we can go create that. We talked about software licensing efficiency, and I think VMware is an easy one to understand. Normally, we buy a box, I pay my VMware license, I virtualize the hardware in that box. When I need another storage device to virtualize, I buy another box and I pay for another software license. In a disaggregated world, when my software license runs out of a physical SSD to virtualize, I don't buy more software. I just compose more physical assets under that same software license, and I get extended life out of my software license that I paid on that server. And most software is actually charged by, you know, x86 processor, right? And so when we can decouple device to x86, we can actually decouple software licensing in many cases. Pay as you grow. Storage gets cheaper every quarter, right? Why do you want to buy all of your storage now? NVIDIA comes out with new GPUs every, you know, handful of months, it seems like. Why do you want to commit all of that now, right? Buy what you need now, buy more later. When you buy it later, we will assimilate it through software into your existing infrastructure. So pay as you grow. Don't over-provision from the get-go. And at the end of the day, this is all about resource utilization improvement. Like the example I gave you. If we can take a rack of infrastructure that's 20% utilized, dynamically reconfigure it for the workload and get 40% utilization out of it, no better way to save money in the data center.
When I look back at this and think where we were when VMware talked about the software-defined data center, and they talked about this concept of being able to just build things that were built out of software, it seemed like a great idea, but then you realized that actually it wasn't that good because there was always going to be that hardware piece which would be massively inefficient because it wasn't granular enough. Now I start looking at this and thinking, well, that granularity has now been broken down to a component level. We still have the issue maybe with the tie-in between processor and memory, but then again, that one isn't as much of a big deal either, because at the end of the day, if I know that I need more compute power, I could just flip those components to a server that has got that compute power and just transition the workload to that server with that compute power. So even that isn't really entirely a big deal anymore, because at the end of the day, as long as I've got enough of those different unit types, I can flex them with the addition of the devices as I need. So in actual fact, we are so much more advanced, I think, with composability towards that software-defined data center, even though it's actually the hardware that you're composing.
No, you're spot on, Chris. The only way we're going to get to two things people call it, the software-defined data center, or now what people are referring to is the lights-out autonomous data center, right? The only way that we are going to get there actually is the marriage of these two technologies. I don't think Composable alone gets you there 100% for all use cases. And I don't think virtualization alone gets you there 100%, right? And so I think it's the marriage of virtualization and composability that will enable the eventual lights out autonomous data center. When an SSD fails, a human is not required to swap out the SSD. When the virtualization layer needs another GPU to go do its VDI thing, a human is not required to be sent into the data center to go fiddle with hardware. When a DRAM module fails inside the data center, as you so eloquently put, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take his SSDs, his GPUs, his boot drive, and even his networking card that's pre-wired to some switch somewhere, and I am going to move all of that stuff to a spare compute node without ever sending a human into the data center, right? And so the only way we get to the lights out autonomous data center is the marriage of these two technologies.
Yeah. So Martin, where do we go when we try and merge composability like this with DPUs and other technology? There's a real interesting scenario that almost everything becomes completely composable. And we could get into a position where we are literally, or almost literally, racking and stacking physical equipment and letting everything else do the rest of it behind the scenes.
I think that's been the promise of composability since day one. I think that's the one thing which we liked. I mean, from my point of view, this feels more right than HCI ever did, because HCI gave you a building block which was very constrained. You had a block, you had another block, you had another block. If you wanted to grow it one way, you couldn't grow it that way, but you'd have to go and buy yourself another block. This seems to give you this idea of you grow the right bit, you don't have to grow it all. And if that right bit now needs to run somewhere else, you move that right bit. So if you have a server which has got or requires GPUs, you can just move them in. You don't actually have to do anything. You don't have to take that server to pieces. You don't have to do anything. You just flip the switch and it's there. From my point of view, this feels right and it feels exciting. And I think this is why we're a bit more excited about this than perhaps we ever were about HCI.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think that's definitely the case. Okay, let's try and at least include a little bit about the technology that we talk about on a regular basis, and that's storage. I'm really interested that you went down the route at one point of a product called Honey Badger. Was it Honey Badger, Sumit?
Honey Badger, yes.
Which was a super high performance SSD device, a PCIe SSD.
Yeah, let me talk about why that's relevant and how that fits into our architecture. So number one is everything that we do is around disaggregation, right? And it just so happens when we talk about things like storage, a M.2 device actually is a really, really good device to disaggregate inside the data center, right? Very small footprint, very high level of performance, very high storage density for the size of the device. It's the mainstream widget that all of the device vendors are, you know, moving towards, and we get to ride economies of scale. Now, the one fundamental issue with the M.2 modules of the world is there's no place to plug them in. There's no actual physical like things out there where we can plug these M.2 modules in. So what Liquid has designed is carriers that allow you to deploy pools of M.2s out into the environment. And we have a small carrier that pools four M.2s together. And then we have a large carrier that pools up to eight M.2s together. And the way that we pool these is through a very small PCIe fabric, right? And so we build a small PCIe fabric that's able to aggregate all of these storage devices together. And then what we do is we layer on a lot of enterprise class functionality at the fabric layer. Things like power loss protection, things like dual ported capability, things like hot plug capability when we're doing it in a U.2 form factor, right? And as a result of this, you end up with a device that has several benefits. Number one, it has very, very high performance, the fastest standalone storage product on the market. A single Honey Badger card can do, you know, north of 3 million IOPS kind of thing. Number two is very, very high capacity device because we're able to aggregate all of these devices together onto a single card. A Honey Badger is 32 terabytes going to 64 terabytes on a single card. But the most important thing is it's built for disaggregation. Now I can put 10 of these Honey Badgers inside of a tray, and then leveraging the Liquid Composable software, I can go grab individual M.2 modules and then compose them off to individual servers. So number one, they make really high performance, high capacity standalone storage devices that can be plugged into any server on the planet, which we do, but then they also fit very well into our composable architecture because they give us a pool of M.2s that we can compose from.
I'm going to go out and dig out a post that I wrote 3 or 4 years ago, which actually says M.2 is the most undervalued form factor for the enterprise. And thank goodness I've now got an ability to go back and reference that and say, here's the reason why I was right all that time ago, even though I didn't realize it, I had no idea I was right. But yeah, I think that's a really interesting one, Martin, because we've seen some other people that do similar technology where they're plugged in and used smaller form factor devices plugged into like an aggregator, if you like. But without the ability to do some degree of composability, you're immediately limited there. But I can see quite a lot of opportunity for that. This is as a method of providing storage to a server.
Yeah, I can see that. You're right about M.2. I think my machines are becoming more and more filled with M.2 devices than anything else because that actually means I can start building them smaller. It's more effective. But you're right, this whole disaggregation but ability to build smaller blocks, I think that's going to be a value for people in the data center space. But this is what it's all about. It's about running those data centers more effectively, more efficiently. It's not just about running your servers at 100% available or 100% efficiency. You're only running your data center as efficient as possible. But these spaces are not cheap. So you might look at your data center, actually, I can now run my data center at 150% more efficient than it was last year. And composability allows me to get much, much closer to it.
Yeah. And I think that, Sumit, this gets us back to the final questions as we sort of come towards that at the end of our time. And that's the idea of whether on-premises now has a bit of a boost from this this type of technology? Because it seems to me that the public cloud has done incredibly well. Public on-premises infrastructure seems to have been the area where people have sort of derided it and said, well, people aren't going to want to run their own data centers anymore. Although there is that middle ground of MSPs, and I'm sure you've got MSPs as customers. But it does seem to be a bit of a boost for this idea of building your own data center, because now you can bring cloud-like functionality to the way you do your own workloads.
Now, listen, I think we are believers in a couple of things. So number one is the pendulum is beginning to swing back more towards the middle here, and this fallacy that the public cloud is going to suck up 100% of the air in the room is, I think a lot of customers are beginning to realize that that's not necessarily the reality of the world. Bimodal IT is what we think is going to be the new norm. Some amount of my workload will live in public cloud. Some amount of my infrastructure, you know, I'm going to own in either on-prem or in a colo environment. And for the infrastructure that I own, either on-prem or in a colo, I want flexibility, I want agility, I want two clicks of a mouse and create a machine. And when I'm done with it, I want to make it somebody else's kind of responsibility. So that composable thing will be driven to on-prem also. What we like to say is Dell sells $390 million a day. And most of that is not going to the public cloud vendor. So somebody on this planet still needs infrastructure, right? And that's probably going to be the case for a very long time. So for all of those people that, you know, need to own infrastructure for one reason or another, you know, we want to give them flexibility, agility on the gear that they're spending money on, right? What did Bank of America say? Bank of America said, we saved $2 billion last year by not going to Amazon. Right, Nike's public saying that they got a $70 million a month Amazon problem, right? Looking at each other saying, you know, I'm spending $800 million a year on Amazon. I can't continue just to put everything on public cloud. Some amount of my workload I'm going to own. And when we talk about workloads like AI, those are actually the most expensive workloads to run on public cloud. Those are the workloads that we save our customers 70%+ running on infrastructure that they own, right? And just turns out those are actually the most mission critical workloads out there.
Another interesting fact, you know, of all of this, Martin, it comes back to yet again this idea of FinOps, because now I'm listening to what Sumit's telling me about my ability to make my data center more efficient. Now I've got scenarios where I can do that, and now I've got to think about my on-premises environment a bit like the cloud. So FinOps comes back to hit us yet again.
Yeah, you know, historically, if you go back 20 years, that the CFO and the CIO were the same person, and we always thought it was crazy. It didn't make any sense, the accountants running the data centers. Well, it sounds like that might actually be the right option at some point.
We're getting back to it, aren't we?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. So what's the maturity of this solution? How much is out there today? And, you know, where is it being used? You mentioned a few examples, but I'd be interested to understand how widespread it is today.
Yeah, no, it's a fair question. And what I'll say is, you know, we are early innings of composability in general. A couple of years ago, when I used to talk to customers about it, it was a relatively new concept. Now customers are aware of it. And I think we're beginning to hit that proverbial, you know, knee of the curve here as far as adoption goes. Liquid now has many dozens of customers that are adopting our technology. So we stand here today where we have tremendous, you know, market pull for our solution. And honestly speaking, we probably don't even have enough people on the team to service all of the demand for, you know, the solution out in the market. So it's a good scenario as a startup to be in. I believe that it will, you know, take time for us to meet, you know, massive market adoption. But there's no doubt in my mind that this is the inevitable endpoint of data center architecture.
Perfect. So, if people want to learn a bit more, go and find out a bit more information. I think it might be important that you spell the website, because obviously it's spelled slightly differently to the word liquid would normally be spelled. So, where can we point people to? Where should we get them to head towards?
Absolutely. The best place is our website, www.liqid.com, liquid without the U. We like to joke and say, liquid, the only thing missing is you.
Great. Okay, fantastic. Well, this has been a great discussion. And I think it was really worth going back and digging in, even though it's not entirely storage related, because it has such an impact on everything else that goes on in the data center. And I think it'll be great in the future to come back and have another chat, probably by the sounds of it, about mining, because that seems to be the biggest thing that everybody's talking about these days. But, you know, otherwise, this has been a great conversation, Sumit. Thank you very much for your time, and we really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Martin. Really appreciate it, guys. Be well.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.